a different topic. An exciting topic of cosmological hydrogen decombination. And you're going to be here for all of today.
All of today.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for having me to tell you about this work. I'm working on cosmological hydrogen recombination, and in particular, the effect of extremely excited states of the hydrogen atom and certain motivating work from the desire to calculate CMB anisotropies accurately enough for Planck data analysis. Something's shaking.
It's just the construction.
Okay. And so motivating it from microwave background anisotropies and from the possibility of seeing radiation leaking towards us from behind the surface of glass scattering, especially from recombination. So I'll start by going through the physics of recombination in a nutshell, and then tell you what goes wrong both with the classic Peebles calculation and the more recent calculation used to create the RecFast code used in W. I'll tell you about our new tool for solving this problem when we have to take into account a very large number of states. And then I'll tell you about the physics of the forbidden transitions we've also included. And then I'll start to show you some results, beginning with properties of the primordial plasma and moving on to implications for CMB data analysis and also just looking at the free electron fraction as a function of time. And then I'll try to outline some ideas I have for future work in this area. So the big driver for all of this science is the ongoing Planck mission. Planck is at L2. It's taking data. There are maps. Some people have even analyzed those maps, but not really. But the real hope is that when all is said and done, Planck is going to give us cosmic variance limited measurements of CMB anisotropies up, down, or up to very small angular scales, L of 2500 in the temperature and 1500 in the E-mode polarization. And several groups have gone away and asked the question, how accurately do we need to predict the free electron fraction? And depending on what redshift you're talking about, this can be as a requirement as stringent as several parts in 10 to the 4. So this is an order of magnitude more precise than the RecFast code. And so this has spawned a whole slew of papers on this topic. And the hope is that in time for Planck's first data analysis, this problem will be completely under control, and we'll really be able to believe the cosmological inferences made from Planck data. So one of the most important measurements people hope to make from Planck is essentially to measure the primordial density fluctuation power spectrum. And so there are a few numbers you could hope to constrain. The slope of the primordial power spectrum, or the scalar spectral index, is amplitude, the baryon fraction, and then the optical depth to the surface of glass scattering. So what these likelihood plots show here, the white curves show you a likelihood surface when you've included some bit of atomic physics, in this case some effects in helium recombination, and you've put in certain fiducial cosmological parameters, and they show you what your one-dimensional marginalized likelihoods for these numbers. And the green curves show you what happens when you rerun the analysis but leave out some piece of the physics, namely these effects in helium recombination. And we can see that the peak of the likelihood function moves over, in some cases by a sigma or more, due to all of this atomic physics. Now, a lot of our leverage on new physics in Planck comes from the smallest angular scales, which is exactly where the details of atomic physics and recombination matter. So we can actually translate these sort of phenomenological statements into statements about the early universe. The scalar spectral index is, in the slow roll picture, connected to these two slow roll parameters. So epsilon can be related to the slope of the inflationary potential, and the amplitude also gives us some relationship between the energy scale of inflation and the slow roll parameter itself. So the real point I want to drive home here is that this very high energy physics that we're hoping to learn about using the Planck satellite, energy scales of between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 16 GeV, depending on how outlandish you allow your inflationary models to be, all this physics comes to us through a filter at an electron bulk energy scale. So you really have to do that right in order to make robust inferences. And for, well, this is more of a sales pitch for skeptics about inflation, this won't be as much of an issue here, but even if you don't believe in inflationary theory, one of the interesting measurements you can make that has been made from WMAP is the optical depth between us and the surface of last scattering. So that inference will also be off if we don't do the recombination problem correctly. So going to the actual physics, what's going on is that we have photons in kinetic equilibrium with electrons, and if we change the electron density, the efficiency of this process is going to change, and that's going to move all the microwave background multiple moments over. This essentially enters all of the relevant equations through this visibility function, which depends on the optical depth, and it just parameterizes the probability that some photon last scattered at some epoch. So there are a few simple effects that you can see in recombination that affect the CMB anisotropy multiple moments. One is a suppression of the CMB C sub Ls at high angular scales just by a factor of e to the minus 2 times the optical depth between us and the surface of last scattering, or the optical depth between us and any epoch, in fact. And physically, this effect is just coming from the fact that if we have some CMB hotspot, and we have photons propagating to us from that hotspot, there are some relic-free electrons left over from the recombination process. This is essentially the relic, the freeze-out fraction of free electrons. And those can constant scatter the CMB photons and thus wash out the temperature of the saturation. The other way in which the details of the recombination process matter is that there's a diffusive dampening that takes place in the CMB temperature of multiple moments. It kicks in at around L of 1,000. This is the famous silk damping. And this diffusion length scale is intimately related to the electron density. So again, we have to get the electron density right to predict how the CMB is damped at small angular scales. As far as the anisotropies go, the last big piece of physics affected by the recombination history is the CMB polarization. The relevant physics here is that if we begin with some isotropic radiation field, and so imagining two unpolarized photons coming into a scatterer, and now imagine that it gets rescattered in this direction, the electron jiggles like so, and so we emit unpolarized radiation. Whereas if we have a quadrupole radiation field, the electron can only move in this direction, so it can't emit this polarization because that's not orthogonal to the propagation vector. So we have to have a quadrupole to pick up a CMB polarization, and this is how recombination physics enters the picture. First of all, you need time to develop a quadrupole, and at really early times, we have this tightly coupled fluid that isotropizes, so we need to stream or project these monopole and dipole moments into higher order moments. And that doesn't happen until the fluid's starting to decouple. And then we need time to rescatter that quadrupole. So actually, the details of recombination are almost doubly important for polarization, because you have to both develop this quadrupole and rescatter it. Moving from the immediately observable to the somewhat more speculative, the recombination process, all these bound-bound atomic transitions from recombination, are going to emit photons, line photons. And some of these, not all of them, but some of them will actually leak through to us from the surface of last scattering and lead to a distortion to the perfect, nearly perfect black body spectrum of the CMB. And so if we plot the CMB intensity spectrum and then plot the distortions here, we can see that it's a tiny signal, several parts in 10 to the 7. So depending on which experimentalist I'm talking to, this is either totally outlandish or really interesting. I haven't gotten a totally straight answer. But aside from sort of just the qualitative fact that this is our first direct test of recombination physics, we can look behind the surface of last scattering, the other neat thing about this is, in a perfect world, if you were able to measure this spectrum at every frequency, you'd have a measurement across the whole sky that wasn't cosmic variance limited. So you could keep improving, you know, the noise properties of your instrument, get better and better measurements of cosmological parameters. One of the big ones you could really hope to measure a lot better is the primordial helium abundance and the barium density as well.
So why, what controls the fact that this the spectral distortion is much smaller than the CMB?
Essentially, you just don't have everything's very close to the thermal equilibrium, so you have many more photons in the black body than you do in these lines. And the lines themselves are very strongly absorbing lines. So most of the photons in that line don't escape from the fireball. You have some really tiny fraction because the lines are optically thick. And so that really tiny fraction propagates a very small spectral distortion. So the simplest picture you could hope to write down for recombination is just chemical equilibrium between free protons and electrons and the whole hierarchy of excited states of hydrogen. N stands for the excitation number. So you could solve the chemical equilibrium equation for the abundance of free electrons, the famous Saha equation, and you would find that the free electron fraction drops to about a half when the temperature is about 0.3 eV, or if you think in redshift, the redshift of about 1300. That's great, and that does fine for predicting roughly when recombination happens, but it does very poorly at predicting the detailed evolution of the free electron fraction afterwards. And the reason is straightforward. All of the relevant rates keeping these processes in equilibrium fall below the Hubble parameter at a temperature of 0.25 dB. So just when you're starting to recombine, the full non-equilibrium dynamics of the plasma become very important. So the next thing you could hope to do was just let electrons recombine to the ground state. But this is actually totally ineffective. And the reason is that as I recombine to the ground state, I'm going to emit a photon which immediately ionizes my neighbor. It's just due to the very strong ionization cross-section. So this happens much faster than the Hubble time scale, so I get bottlenecked if I just want to go straight to the ground state. The next thing you could hope to do is recombine to excited states. But again, you run into a problem, because as you make your way from some excited state to the ground state, there's a whole resonance series of transitions that are very strongly absorbing. So again, I absorb with a very fast rate, something like this, which is much faster than the Hubble expansion. So the question, you know, in 1965 was, how do I recombine efficiently? And this was the real realization of Jim Peebles, was that I can escape out of these resonances. And there's two channels. One is to go from the two state to the one state by emitting two photons. Then I emit a whole continuum of photon energies that aren't going to re-excite the resonance. And the other thing that can help us out is that if I have a photon that's ever slightly redward of the line center, the Hubble expansion is going to make it even redder. And so it'll move out to the wings of the line, and it can't get resonantly reabsorbed. So the Peebles model just assumed that the only bottleneck was the n equals 2 resonance, and wrote down an equation for the evolution of the free electron fraction. So there are several bits here. This parameterizes the overall recombination state into some state with these quantum numbers. And then we just have the reverse rate in this direction, and this is just a detailed balance factor relating the rates. But of course, none of that has incorporated what I just said about the bottlenecks. And that all lives right here. So what's the behavior of that term? Well, this is sort of a suppression factor that tells us how inefficient recombination is. This first term is the Hubble redshifting term for how I escape out of resonance. This is the two-photon decay term, which is another way out of resonance. And then finally, we have the ionization term from the two states. So all this term is saying is, how efficient is recombination? This is the total number of ways I can get off resonance and efficiently recombine, and this is the total number of things that can happen to an atom that's trying to recombine. So one neat thing about this is you can actually compare these two rates. And the redshifting term doesn't begin to dominate until really late times, until redshifts of about 850. So I like to point out sort of pedagogically. If you're ever teaching a quantum mechanics course and your students don't want to learn about forbidden transitions, you really ought to tell them that that's how half the atoms in the universe form, so they should care. So this Peebles picture was state-of-the-art for 30 years, and you can see how badly the equilibrium fails right here. Saha falls off exponentially, and here we see the freeze-out happening very nicely. And we can develop some intuition for how things depend on cosmological parameters. As we drive up the overall mass density, the Hubble parameter goes up, and we end up with the faster expansion and an earlier freeze-out, and that leaves us with more free electrons. On the other hand, driving up the baryon density, we make recombination more efficient, so we're left with fewer free electrons. So what are the assumptions of the Peebles model? Three that are buried in there that I didn't tell you about before. One is that it's assumed that all the different angular momentum substates of the hydrogen atom are populated in statistical equilibrium. This amounts to assuming that all the rates connecting those are infinitely efficient. And that assumption, of course, breaks down at late times as the rates become inefficient relative to the expansion of the universe. The other assumption is that the higher excited states are populated in thermal equilibrium. And again, because the different energy shells are populated in thermal equilibrium, but that of course breaks down as well for the very same reason. And finally, people assume that the matter and radiation temperatures were locked, but Thomson scattering, which keeps them locked, actually becomes inefficient. So the first correction to these approximations was done by Sarah Seeger, Doug Scott, and Peter Sasilov, and their big multi-level atom calculation is at the part of the RecFast code. They basically fit to that. They correct the Peebles calculation, and they keep track of all the populations of the excited states. But the one thing they don't do is they don't break this assumption. And this is the assumption that makes the problem very big. It's not important for WMAP, but it is important for Planck data analysis. So the importance of those of following those different states separately was first realized by Jens Chalupa over at SIA. And when you follow the different states separately, it turns out that, the calculation becomes expensive. And the furthest that that group has been able to push so far is an Nmax of about 100 or 110. And they're still seeing 0.1% level corrections.
So sorry, what was the Nmax for?
So Seeger et al. Go to 300, but they are treating all these states as being in statistical equilibrium. So once you break that assumption, the computation time for the Nmax of 300 case would be several months or even years on your standard workstation. And we can qualitatively start to understand the effect of evolving the separate states separately. And that's just that because the different angular momentum subspaces can only talk to each other in a way that changes L by 1, that's just our usual selection rule, the high angular momentum states get stuck. They can't decay to the ground state, so you slow down recombination. So the question is, once we have this computational bottleneck, how are we to proceed if we want a few parts in 10^-4 accuracy for our predictions of C sub L for Planck? And so there's there are two ways you could think about doing it. One is throwing the truck at it and going off to a supercomputer. The unfortunate thing is we want to develop intuition for how things scale with different cosmological parameters. So if you really want to explore a parameter space, it becomes very inefficient to just run off to a supercomputer without knowing what depends on what. So, and ultimately, you want to develop a fast code anyway. So we decided to go right for that. So the overall question we were trying to address with this paper is how high do you have to go? How many states do you have to include? And one thing I do want to emphasize is that often when you go to very high end, people start to worry about whether these are really bound states. So you are getting very close to the continuum in terms of energy. So you might start to worry about collective effects in the plasma. But in this density and temperature regime, you essentially can compare the Debye length of the plasma to how far the electron is from the center of the atom. And it's still safely inside of the Debye screening length. So you can still think of these states as real atomic states. But they're really big. I don't know how big a bacteria is off the top of my head. But these atoms are like 2 microns at an Nmax of 200. So the other thing you might worry about is thermal smearing. These states, their smearing is less than the inter-level spacing, at least for these n. So we don't have to do a continuum problem yet, but if it turns out that we have to go to much higher n, that might be something you have to worry about. But these are actual real transition lines people see in interstellar emission regions. So they're often used as diagnostics for the temperature and density of a plasma. They're really out there.
So what is that ratio, delta E thermal divided by E?
So this condition is just saying I have some thermally broadened line, a thermally broadened level due to all the thermally broadened lines. And so the width of a level due to thermal broadening, if that broadening were to smear adjacent levels, it wouldn't make sense to talk about them as separate states.
So what is that ratio in the problem? So delta E thermal is like the temperature?
It's the thermally broadened line.
It's 0.3 electron volt?
No, it's not that big because the temperatures are all very non-relative. They're still non-relativistic temperatures. So the width of the line is like 10^-4 or something like that.
Ah, okay.
So the point is that that's small compared to this number. So what's the effect of resolving the separate angular momentum subspace?
But 10^-4 is not a small compared to that number. But that number is 10^-4.
I mean, it depends on the line. So, right, so for Okay, I have to check the numbers, but we compared things for all levels, and we were, you know, around 1 to 2 orders of magnitude below having to worry about a thermally rotting stuff. So the effect of resolving these separate states is exactly what I sort of implied earlier. When I keep track of the angular momentum substates separately, recombination becomes less efficient, and so I have fewer free electrons at the lattice times. So what's the tool we brought to bear on this problem? We have a new code called RexParse, and we solve the multi-level atom problem. We keep track of dipole bound-bound transitions between all of the different bound states of the hydrogen atom. Dipole allowed bound free transitions. These two photon transitions between the 2s and 1s states. Now, there are also two photon transitions from the whole cascade of higher excited states, and that's where Chris Arata has worked out in detail. That's under good control, so here we're just trying to isolate the effect of the very highly excited states. And so then we solve for the evolution of the free electron correction. And there are several pieces here. One is this 2s to 1s decay rate, this two photon escape channel, which dominates at early times. And the other channel is that we have, you know, even though we have these bottlenecked resonant transitions to the ground state, some fraction of the photons escapes off resonance due to the redshift, due to the expansion of the universe. And so this rate is controlled by, one, the fundamental rate coefficient for the process, the Einstein coefficient, and then this escape probability. And I'll try to explain where that comes from in just a second. So the escape probability is treated in something called the Sobolev approximation. It's a solution to the equation of radiative transfer that just depends on assuming you're in perfect steady state and scattering is incoherent. And in that case, the probability of escaping off a resonant line with these sets of quantum numbers is just given by 1 minus the exponential of the negative optical depth over the optical depth. And the optical depth is given by this here, and I'll try to explain where everything comes from in just one second. So this is just the density of resonant absorbers, how many targets I have to absorb a resonant photon. And then this Einstein coefficient tells me how quickly I do so. So the numerator here just tells me how quickly I'm absorbing resonant photons, how efficient the trapping is, basically. And then here I have the other time scale in the problem, which is the Hubble expansion scale. So this just compares the two channels and tells me, through that probability, how likely I am to escape off resonance. So a lot of the recent work in recombination physics was focused on moving beyond this Sobolev approximation, solving the radiative transfer equation in gory detail. But in this work, we're actually focusing on higher excited states. So we work in the Sobolev approximation, but of course the end goal is to combine everything on this list of corrections into one final recombination code. So we have deviations from steady state, coherent scattering, atomic recoil, diffusion near resonance lines, line overlap, feedback from helium, higher two photon processes, deuterium. It's a zoo, but it's starting to look like things are under control. So how does the RexSparse code work? We solve for the evolution of the excited state populations, and you can write this as a nice little linear differential equation. And all the atomic physics sits in here. But one point I really want to stress here, because this is what lets us solve the problem on the very high end, is that this vector does not include the ground state population. It includes everything else. And there's a physical reason for why that helps you out. But just to give you a picture, this vector of atomic populations includes the populations of all the different angular momentum substates. But it's very important that we group things by angular momentum. And so each of these little guys has all of the n's that are consistent with some L value. So this matrix, this big rate matrix, is Bloch tridiagonal. And that's not just a mathematical statement. There's physics in that statement. So these diagonal blocks include all the bound-bound transitions out of some state L to the other L, photoionization out of that state, and two photon transitions to the ground state. And the off-diagonal bits just tell us how the other states feed into the state we're presently interested in. But again, remember, I've left out all of the flux from the ground state from this vector x. And so that all lives here. How we talk to the continuum through recombinations to some L, and how we talk to the ground state through escape from resonance and two photon transitions lives in here. And so as long as you're restricting yourself to states above the ground state, if you do some estimates, you see that the fastest this rate, the slowest this rate can be is about 1 per second, all through recombination. On the other hand, recombination itself takes place on a much slower time scale. So the rate here is something like 1 part in 10 to the 12 per second. So what that means is that instead of solving a system of 20,000 coupled stiff differential equations, you can drop this term, and this becomes a linear algebra problem plus one differential equation to solve, which is just the free electron fraction. And so that's what we do. Okay, so now we have a really big matrix to invert. How do we proceed from there? Well, the matrix is n max squared by n max squared on a side, which would seem hard. If you work out the inversion time, which would naively scale as n max to the sixth, you would see that a single recombination time step would take 10 to the 5 seconds to calculate at an n max of 200, and you want to run several hundred time steps to get a reasonable history, so this would become prohibitively expensive. Fortunately, dipole selection will save the day.
So, why do you have to invert it at each step? Isn't it enough to just invert it once?
No, because everything is temperature dependent. You have bound-free transition rates, you have escape probabilities, all of those numbers depend on the density of the plasma. So you have to do this at every time step. So the matrix looks like this. Remember, it's block tridiagonal. And that block tridiagonality is just telling you physically that I have this dipole selection rule. I can only talk to my neighbors in angular momentum states, not angular momentum states. So if I just denote each of these blocks with this letter M, it only couples the L minus 1 state to the L state to the L plus 1 state. So that can be solved in closed form just in terms of these blocks and the blocks of this vector here. And so you can do that to very quickly implement that, to very quickly invert the matrix. So the end result is a code that has a recombination history that can be generated with a computation time that scales as nmax to the 2.5. instead of nmax to the 6, that's an empirical scale. But one thing that I do want to stress to sort of put some of the future work in context is that we do have states beyond our cutoff. And we're basically artificially setting our communication with those states through the rates to 0. So that can introduce some additional absolute error relative to the relative errors that we're exploring. And I think there's some interesting physical approaches to trying to put a real cap on that error. But the nice thing is that the code is fast. In case of nmax of 100 runs in like 4 hours, it would take 6 days with the previous best code. And the nmax 200 case, which was intractable before, takes 4 days. And in fact, we've now solved the nmax of 300 case. That took 2 weeks, but it's still tractable now, which is nice, but we might want to think about other ways to speed up our code if we want to turn knobs there.
So how complicated are the temperature dependencies?
The scalings are fairly... The things that are sort of messy to calculate are the optical depths. Sort of the bound free rates are fairly, have pretty, you know, there's an exponential and 1/1 the temperature.
What I'm wondering is if there are multiple time scales in the temperature change, then you can sort of like do approximate solution. I was wondering if you do approximate solutions that would carry take you through the, where you could invert once, take several steps, and then invert again, take several steps. Essentially using some kind of half algebraic, half numeric solution.
Well, that's more or less what we do.
Oh, is that what you do?
Yeah. I mean, we increment at each time step, but by breaking down this matrix into little blocks, you know, you don't have to invert the whole matrix. We've sort of optimally extracted the solution at each time step. So that's the story with the high-end states. I'm sort of going to show you my toolbox, and then I'm going to show you what comes out. So the other thing you might worry about are forbidden transitions in hydrogen. And so Chris and Holopenko have shown that higher N2 photon transitions can actually move the likelihood peak of the CMB over by 7 sigma. So that's a huge effect. And so it's interesting to consider whether or not other forbidden transitions are actually important in a way that's important for Planck data analysis. The one we've actually looked at is the electric quadrupole transitions in hydrogen. So there's not that much you need to know about these transitions. Remember, we have this probability for escape off resonance. The overall rate scales as this probability multiplied by the relevant Einstein coefficient. But if we're looking at optically thick lines, we can forget about this bit, and so we just have 1 over the optical depth. But the optical depth, as you may remember, just scales as the Einstein coefficient. So the point is that the net rate of different optically thick lines sort of saturates to a constant. So if I have 2 optically thick lines, the fact that one is 10 to the 8th thick and the other one is 10 to the 4th, they could at least in principle be equally important in the recombination problem. So it's important to take that into account. Now, as you may remember, quadrupole transitions have a selection rule of delta L equals plus or minus 2, and our whole inversion scheme depended on delta L equals plus or minus 1. Fortunately, the first thing I wanted to do was just go generalize the algebra, right? But there's a simpler thing you can do, which is just consider transitions to and from the ground state in the quadrupole approximation. So it turns out that the rates go as the frequency to the 5th power, so the rates to the ground state are greater than those to the n equals 2 state by a factor of 10 to the 3, and that's only going to get more and more extreme as you go to higher excited states. So as a first pass to see if there's any importance to these transitions, we can just include transitions to and from the ground state. And that makes our life simpler for the following reason. If we have some nd to 1s transition, because these Lyman lines are optically thick, the ground state atom is going to immediately absorb a photon and make its way to the p state. So what that means is there's some net transition rate connecting different angular momentum states with the rate that depends on this Einstein coefficient multiplied by this population. And so because of that, we can actually use the same sparsity patterns we were using before. This just adds another flux between p and d states, which is still delta L equals plus or minus 1. So the overall rate is given by this bit here, where we have the same Einstein coefficient I was talking about, and then we have a forward and a backward rate. So this 5/3 is just a ratio of statistical 2L plus 1s for the L equals 1 and 2 states. So it just tells us that we have forward and backward rates, and that this can push us back towards equilibrium, because we have introduced a new way for the different angular momentum states to talk to each other. So, I'm going to group the results first by properties of the gas, which help you build some intuition for what's going on, and then I'll cut to the chase with the free electron fraction and the effects on the CMB. So here I show the deviations from statistical equilibrium for a 140-shell calculation for 2 different shells and as a function of the angular momentum. And so what's going on here is that for low L, we're underpopulated relative to equilibrium because these are efficiently cascading states that can find their way to the ground state pretty quickly. So those are underpopulated. As I push to L equals 0, I don't have an L equals minus 1 state, so that efficiency sort of goes down and we have a little upturn there. As we go to higher L, we are bottlenecked by this selection rule, so we can't make our way to the ground state, so these states are overpopulated. And finally, as we cut to really high L, even though we're bottlenecked, there's no efficient process feeding those states at the beginning. The recombination rate falls off there. But the real lesson to take away here is that this deviation from equilibrium gets worse and worse at late times. So if you're interested in the evolution of the late-time free electron fraction, it's crucial to resolve these states. One thing we were wondering is what explains this little kink at L equals 2. And it actually turns out there's a very simple explanation there. The rates out of the D states are larger than the rates out of the P and the S states. So L equals 2 depopulates more rapidly than the other states, and that explains the little bit. So we can test that just by turning off these transitions. This is just a sanity check to make sure that little kink wasn't some artifact of our integration scheme. And we see that when we turn off these Balmer transitions, indeed, the kink in a 50-shell calculation moves from L equals 2 to L equals 1. But one thing I really want to emphasize is the magnitude of these deviations. These are not small deviations from statistical equilibrium. This is in percent. This is 10 or 20%. It's a very large deviation from statistical equilibrium. Now, there is one effect that can push you in the other direction. And this is one of the great sort of unresolved bits of physics, the whole recombination problem. And I really hope I can get people everywhere excited about this because it's sort of an embarrassingly unsolved problem in atomic physics. So everything I've told you about so far is for the purely radiative case. So I haven't included the probability that some passing electron excites transition between 2 atomic states. If I use the best existing estimates of those rates and make the same sort of plot I just showed you, this is from one of Jens's papers, you see that you're pushed much closer towards statistical equilibrium. You're giving the different angular momentum substates one more way to talk to each other. It's really embarrassing, but these rates are unknown to factors of two. The last time they were relevant for any problem of interest was when these very highly excited interstellar emission lines were first seen in the 1960s and 70s. So people went away and calculated these rates to try to understand the lines they were seeing. As far as I can tell, the community sort of collectively sighed and gave up in 1980, probably because the spectra just weren't that good. But at this point, these collisional rates are becoming very important again. And once I show you one or two more plots, I think you'll get some intuition for why they're so important. So for getting angular momentum, we can plot the deviations of the gas from being in Boltzmann equilibrium with the ground state. So we can see this white curve shows us what's going on at early times. At redshift of 1300, we're really close to equilibrium with the ground state. So Peebles' assumption is really good. As we go to later and later times, the deviations at high end from the ground state get very large, as much as 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 at late times. As we go to high end, the states are much closer to each other, so there's sort of less distinguishable difference there. But the basic effect going on here is that we're feeding these states much more efficiently than we're depopulating. The recombination rates are much greater than the downward bound-bound transition rates, so these guys get stuck in very highly excited states. Now, one point I do want to stress is that this plot in and of itself does not show population inversion. It just shows us that we're overpopulated relative to thermal equilibrium, but the highly excited states are still less populated than the lower energy states. However, we do see some population inversion between pairs of closely spaced states between n equals 40 and n equals 80. That's a tentative result because, as I've said, there are no collisions in this calculation, and that's exactly the sort of thing that could be very sensitive to the collisional rates. And another question is, what happens when you really solve the radiative transfer problem in detail instead of making a Sokolov approximation? It's possible that we have a laser pointing to us from the surface of last scattering, which would take these tiny spectral distortions and possibly dial them up by 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. Which would take sort of this spectral distortion project from the realm of really out there, might happen before I'm dead, to, you know, maybe something that can be feasibly done in the next 30 years. The last sort of thing I want to say about the populations of the gas is we can also, in addition to equilibrium with the ground state, we can compare with equilibrium with the continuum, that's so-called Saha equilibrium. At low end or at late times, we're really far out of equilibrium. But as we go to the high end, we sort of start to approach. In the first plot, we're saying we're comparing with thermal equilibrium between some state and the n equals 2 state. Here, we're comparing between thermal equilibrium between some state and the continuum. So basically, am I in equilibrium with photons connecting me to the ground state, or am I in equilibrium with photons that could ionize the atom? So, I mean, the trends, everything is self-consistent. These are just sort of different ways of showing the trends. But this way is actually somewhat more informative because we're seeing an asymptote towards equilibrium with the continuum at very high end. So this goes back to this problem of what's past our truncation limit that I was talking about before. You can see that if these equilibrium populations are really good at high end and the rates themselves have very nice asymptotics.
So for the temperature, but you have temperature, then you assume it is one temperature in all cases, right?
No, this is the real two-temperature plasma. So the photons have the gas temperature, and the free electrons have the matter temperature, and we're following.
And this Saha equation, you put this temperature to
Well, it's sort of subtle how you define Saha equilibrium when you have a two-temperature plasma. So we sort of played the game both ways, both putting the gas, the photon temperature in everywhere, the matter temperature in everywhere, or the two separate temperatures, with the photon temperature showing up in the exponential, because that tells me how I talk between bound states, and then the matter temperature showing up in the temperature to the 3/2 factor, because that tells me about sort of the full phase space of the unbound electrons. But it turns out that the shape of these plots is more or less invariant to that choice. But if we can populate those really highly excited states in perfect Saha equilibrium and use the asymptotic scalings for the rates, you can imagine some sort of effective source term to model the effect of everything we've left out. The unfortunate thing is, if you ask how close you need to be to Saha to make that approximation, it turns out that using our results, if you just sort of ballpark things, you would need to go to an nmax of 1,000 to sort of have that transition between keeping track of everything and having the effective rate coefficient. But things aren't as bad as they look, because once this problem of atomic collisions is under control, that pushes you towards equilibrium much faster. So this transition n could be down at about 150 or 200, and then we could really move from exploring questions of relative convergence, which is all anyone can do right now, to questions of absolute convergence. And that's sort of important for implications for the CMP, so let me move in that direction. So now I'm going to show you how the free electron fraction changes between different recombination histories. So essentially what I'm doing here is I'm doubling the nmax. I'm sweeping through the logarithmic range of number of shells I can consider, and just considering the relative errors between different levels of approximation. And so this plot just shows you all of the recombination histories themselves just plotted over each other on the log-log plot. So the lesson is, staring at this, we can't tell them apart. So we're talking about precision cosmology here. So here are the changes in the free electron fraction. As we can see, the free electron fraction gets lower and lower the more states I consider. And what's happening there is that the net effect of adding more shells is that I have more ways to get from the continuum to the ground state. And the nice thing is that the relative correction is shrinking as I include more and more levels. So there is some kind of relative convergence going on here. But one thing I do want to point out is this is the relative error. I could have some unconstrained error between the n equals infinity case and what I'm doing. So it's important to try to get a handle on how things would scale out to a very high n and to solve that problem of the collisions.
So couldn't this be done analytically?
That's the hope, yeah. The trick is getting to a high enough n where we can accurately sort of have the analytic term in there, because it's not good enough for n of 200, but maybe good enough for
100. How do you know it's not good enough for n of 200?
Because the deviation from Saha equilibrium is still of order 20%. And so if you turn that and allow that to vary, you see that you still produce large changes in the free electron fraction for a 10% deviation from equilibrium. But you know, we may get much closer to equilibrium once we have a good feel for the collisional rates.
But you don't have to be close to equilibrium in order to be able to do things. Is that what you're saying? That you think that?
Well, you do if you want to use equilibrium populations in your analytic forms. So you have to. I mean, you can't solve for the population itself analytically. That's followed through these rate equations. So if you wanted to do things analytically, you'd want to be in a regime where the populations themselves were given by some equilibrium expression. But I mean, that is the direction.
But I mean, if you think they're in equilibrium, that's probably. But I'm just thinking that for large, in the large n regime, there must be some scaling with n, like n some power, and one can probably make an ansatz.
Oh yeah. That's like two slides from that.
Okay.
So yeah, we do make that ansatz, but the point is we want to confirm the ansatz.
Sure.
So here I've shown n of 250. I've actually now gone up to 300, but haven't yet had a chance to plot this into the plot. Here's, in sharp contrast to these, you know, differences which look like they could be important for the CMB, namely through the change in the late time free electron fraction. So you can already guess how it's going to change things. It's going to change that e to the minus 2 tau damping I had way at the beginning. In contrast, we can look at the difference between recombination histories with and without these quadrupole transitions. And in this case, again, they speed up recombination by giving me ways for different angular momentum substates to talk to each other. But we see that even at peak, the difference between quadrupole transitions is 10 to the minus 5. And I think what's going on here is it's one of these cases where you do an order of magnitude estimate to see how big something is. The order of magnitude estimate tells you it's marginal. It could be important. And then you forgot the 16 pi squared. So these things do matter. But physically, I think what's going on here also is that we don't have two arbitrary optically thick transitions. Remember, I said if you have two things that are saturated, they could both be important. They actually lie right on top of each other. So one transition eats all the other transitions' photons. So even though they're comparably optically thick, the weaker line can't make a huge difference in the recombination history. But it is sort of fun to understand the shape of a slot. So these balls, having more balls in a slot just tells me I have more atoms in that state. So for low n, n less than 5 and at early times, the overpopulation is in this direction. So I flow from the d state to the p state, which then decays down to 2s. But because 2s to 1s is the dominant recombination channel at these early times, that's the fast 2-photon rate, adding these transitions at early times speeds up recombination. And so that's why this overall curve is positive. That's why it has the direction that it does. As I go to higher n at the early times, the inversion of which states are overpopulated goes in the other direction. So I flow this way in the diagram, down to 2p. But remember, this guy is bottlenecked due to these resonances. So that slows down recombination relative to what the quadrupoles do at low n. So that's why the amplitude of these curves shrinks as I go to high n. Once I go to late times, things are much simpler. The overpopulations are all in this direction. So I flow from p to d, and then down to 2p. But remember, now I've left the regime where the two-photon transitions are dominant. It's this resonant escape mechanism that's dominant. And so now, again, I speed up recombination. You see that here. As I dial up n at late times, I see more and more efficient recombination processes. But, you know, it's fun to understand the shape of curves, but if you take one thing away from this plot, so that this is a tiny correction, now you might think that integrated over all of recombination still might cause a detectable effect in Planck. So we did play that game. And so the next question I want to move to is the effect of these corrections to the recombination history on microwave background observables. So the way we make these plots is we take our recombination histories and we put them into the RecFast code and replace the recombination history of RecFast with the recombination history that we have using a consistent set of cosmological parameters. So this is the TTI anisotropy, and we're just comparing, again, doublings in the nmax levels in the number of n that we're considering. So here we go from 32 to 64 up to 128 and 256. So you can understand the shape of this curve quite simply. At low L, we're looking at scales that are super horizon at the surface of last scatter. So those scales don't care about recombination, so the differences all go to zero. Once we go to high L, remember, we're changing the free electron fraction, not at the peak of the CMB visibility function, where most photons last scatter, but all on that long tail of the visibility function, where we're re-scattering primary anisotropies and washing them out. So this is described by this e to the minus 2 tau plateau at high L. And so what happens is that as we speed up recombination by adding more levels, tau goes down because we have fewer free electrons along the line of sight. And so C sub L, the change in C sub L is positive, but again shrinking as I go to higher and higher n. And so it turns out that the line for Planck sort of cuts through around here. I'll make that statement a little more precise in a minute. And so it's initially sort of frightening because it looks like you're just getting beneath the error budget around an nmax of 250 for this one effect. And there was that list of 15. So you might worry that you're eating your whole error budget with one effect, and that would make the data analysis sort of...
Is that a variance Planck error?
Cosmic variance is like up here, but the point is that you actually want to do better than cosmic variance for your whole sample on average. I mean, it's still cosmic variance, but the point is the usual formula you're used to, where you just go as 1 over square root of L, that's the cosmic variance error on one multiple moment. But the question you really want to ask is how well do you want to predict all your multiple moments on average? So I used to draw a flat line. The flat line for how well you want to do is like about here on average. But a lot of people looked at that and said, no, isn't cosmic variance 1 over square root of L? So many people were confused by that I decided to leave it out and let it.
But it should be like 1 over L out there, I think, because
you have to... That's right. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the scale. So. Now we can ask the same sort of question for the E-mode polarization anisotropies. And qualitatively, so these plots are interesting, right? Because remember, polarization depends on recombination in a multitude of ways. I rescatter primary anisotropies at the surface of last scattering, but I also change the width of the surface last scattering. So if I speed up recombination, you might think, okay, surface of last scattering is thinner, and so I get less polarization. But things actually go in the exact opposite direction. And the reason is just that our change is dominant at late times. So the properties of the visibility function are almost completely unaffected. And so we're just changing how we rescatter CMB photons. So the high L scaling is exactly the same as in the case of the temperature. The only thing that's different is that at low L, we're no longer asymptoting to one curve. And the reason there is actually also very straightforward. We're no longer looking at the largest super horizon modes. We're looking at a rescattered monopole from sort of the whole power spectrum. So recombination does care about low L here. Just to make sure that sort of the integrated effect of these quadrupoles, which are sort of marginal, doesn't lead to, over all time, a statistically important change in the CMD, we looked at the delta C sub L's for the different quadrupole cases. So here we're just comparing C sub L with and without a quadrupole. Again, by making recombination go faster, we have less suppression due to rescattering of CMB photons, and so we have a higher C sub L. In the quadrupole case, the effect of the quadrupoles is more or less converged by an nmax of 30, and we see it's 2 parts in 10 to the 6. So that's way below cosmic variance, so all you have to remember is that you can forget about these transitions. And the same sort of statement holds for the e-mode polarization and isotropies. So now I think I'm going to answer the question Nayesh asked. We can look at the relative error and just sort of swap what gets a curve and what gets an axis. And so as we look at the scaling with n at a variety of times, at early times we have some sort of smooth turnover going on. But then as we start doubling the number of shells considered, I can basically hold this hockey stick through the points. And all that means is that I have what's more or less described by a power law for the relative error scaling. And so empirically, this error is shown to scale as nmax to the 1.9. Now, the nice thing is when you do have a power law scaling like this, you can show that there's a straightforward mapping from relative errors to absolute errors. You can basically extrapolate to the absolute error in the free electron fraction and then propagate that on through to the absolute error in the microwave background multiple moments. And so now we can start to ask the question of how this is going to affect data analysis for the CMB. So the way we like to answer this question in our group is not through big Monte Carlo simulations, but through the Fisher matrix. The Monte Carlo simulations will come in handy once we have the complete picture of recombination in hand. And so this is the so-called Z statistic. Z is given by this expression, and Z is just the number of sigma that our likelihood function is going to move over due to some piece of physics we haven't included. And so there are several pieces in here. Here are the changes in the C sub L's. And I'm just summing over L and L prime. And then these X and Y just denote the different power spectra I could take. So X and Y range over TT, EV, TB, and then you can throw in B if you want to, but I'm not going to do the permutations out loud. And then the other thing that is important here is F, L, L prime. And that is the covariance matrix of the data. And that contains two pieces. One is the error you're going to expect due to cosmic variance, and one is a realistic estimate of the real error in an experiment due to beam noise, finite sky coverage, things like that. So what we used is we looked up the beam profile from the Planck Blue Book, which will hopefully describe Planck, and estimated how far the likelihood peak would move over once we've extrapolated these errors to even the end we haven't considered. And so the point is that the sort of fiducial value of nmax of 60, which everyone's using in their training sets at the moment, will throw off your likelihood peak by 2 sigma. Now, this isn't the 7 sigma of the 2 photon transitions, but it's important enough that you might start to worry about things. Once you're at nmax of 128, you're sort of marginally converged. Your peak is only going to move 1 sigma, or half a sigma. And once you're at nmax of 250, you can sort of go home. But the one caveat I would put in here is that collisions may ease the process. Jens Chaluba has put the collisional rates in some of his calculations. In his case, he only did that going up to an nmax of 30, and he saw that the collisions don't make a huge difference in the free electron fraction. You know, they're sort of 1 part in 10 to the 5. If that's true, then, you know, this is sort of the end of the story. But, you know, remember that the states we're really worried about are those high-end states. So if collisions help those come closer to equilibrium, this whole convergence problem could actually be much faster. So I think that's still something to sort out. So, to wrap up, we have a new tool for multi-level atom calculations in recombination, and if you're interested, there's its phone number. And the two sort of takeaway points of this paper are that highly excited states of the hydrogen atom are relevant for Planck data analysis, but that quadrupole transitions in hydrogen are not relevant. And there are some directions for future work here. One of the first and most straightforward things I can do with my code is include the effect of overlap between different atomic lines. Once you get past NF40, the different lines, the tails of their profiles actually start to touch. And so that would cause a correction to that resonant escape probability, because essentially, even if I escape off line N, I could leak into line N plus 1 and still get stuck. One of the students in our group, Yassine Ali Haimoud, has developed a really nice analytic formalism for correcting the Sobolev approximation in this case. And so it should be very straightforward to include that in the REC sparse code and see how important line overlap is. The other big thing that I think needs to be done is figure out, identify the collisional rates, which are most important, if any, for the recombination problem, and then try to calculate these rates in a better way for first principles. And that's some hard physics. And so that's something I'm very interested in doing. At the moment, my code just gives you a free electron fraction as a function of time. But I'd like to start exploring the question of the spectrum of these spectral distortions. Particularly, I'm really excited about these cosmological masers. They could tell us, open a whole window, a new window into the high redshift universe. And finally, of course, it would be informative to generalize this Fisher analysis I've done to a real, realistic estimate of cosmological parameter estimation. So I'll stop there and take any questions.
Thanks a lot. So questions for Dan?
Mark? So this masers thing, is there any reason to expect that the masers should happen, or is it just you're kind of hoping it will?
Sorry?
Is there some like underlying reason why you should expect the masers?
Well, there's definitely a reason to expect large deviations from thermal equilibrium, because the rates are inefficient. So I think the answer to that question is there's all kinds of pumping processes going on. And the point is that in a certain regime of density and temperature, you know, N equals 79 is going to be less efficiently overpopulated than N equals 80. And so then you'll actually have not just overpopulation relative to equilibrium, but overpopulation relative to each other. So you'll have a narrow window of states that are actually more populated than their immediate neighbors and energies, than their lower energy neighbors. But yeah, it would be nice to sit down and work out some analytic scalings to see, you know, how broad a range you expect this to happen. But you know, we do see masers in interstellar emission regions.
I just was wondering if it was the same processes. I guess I couldn't figure it out.
So in those processes, so this is a purely radiative calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Usually masers are collisionally pumped.
Yeah, that's what I recall.
But the density regime is completely different here. But you know, that's a really important, that's one more reason to calculate the collisional rates. They could take this population inversion and completely smear it out. In which case, you know, that's another thing that could help you actually is, this is a little bit more speculative, but there were some really neat papers in the early 90s by Spans and Norman, where they considered the inhomogeneous recombination problem. So if I have some clump of matter at my surface of last scattering, I'm going to have a much higher collisional rate there than in the plasma as a whole. And so I'll excite these levels, and I could actually not only have, so this is a homogeneous laser. It's a laser pointed at us from the whole last scattering surface. But you can imagine a little blob at the surface of last scattering up and pointing a laser at us from there. And so that would actually constrain structure on something like 10 parsec scales at the surface of last scattering. So if you want to measure the power spectrum on really small scales, well, the 21 centimeter line is probably still a cleaner probe, but this, you could possibly learn something from these masers.
Other questions? Can I ask what the collisional times are? I mean, just give a sense as to how that compares to the radiation times.
They become comparable at late times. So of order, they don't compete with Lyman alpha. The other rates are like 4 or 5 orders of magnitude slower, the non-Lyman alpha rates, and the collisional rates become, so that would be like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 per second, and the collisional rates are comparable at wave times. I mean, it's marginal. They're not like way bigger, but they are comparable.
Yeah, is it 10 to the 5 or 10 to the minus 5?
Okay, so the rate, the Lyman alpha rate, is like 1 per second,
okay.
And that's the slowest rate in the problem. That's the real bottleneck, right?
Okay.
And so the other excited state rates, you know, can be as much as 10 to the, as much as 4 or 5 orders of magnitude larger. And at the highest end and the late times, the collisional rates are comparable to those rates. So the collisions, you can actually do a ballpark estimate of what end the collisions really start to force you closer to equilibrium. And that's at about 150. So my guess would be that my statement about convergence at n of 128 is more or less robust, but the statement about what happens to the recombination history for n of 250 could change, you know, in a significant way once you include the collisions.
Then this amazing thing, if you think of the frequency with which these things collide as opposed to the frequency with which they're emitting this radiation that's supposed to be getting coherent, are they comparable?
I don't know off the top of my head.
That sounds like that would be dangerous.
But yeah, that would be exactly the sort of thing that would destroy the coherence,
yeah.
Right? So that's a good question.
So the question I was asking about the scaling, I was thinking actually of an actual analytic ANSATZ plug-in to your equation. So there seems to be a numerical scaling within. So that probably means that you could guess, at least in the high-end regime, you have your populations would scale with n, like n to some power, and plug-in into your actual.
Oh, and see if you recover that scaling.
Yeah. But 1.9 probably is not what calculate. Maybe it's.
No, I mean that's numerical. Right?
Yeah. But actually there could be a scaling solution to your equations, assuming a very high end. So
yeah, just using the asymptotic scaling of the rates, and then okay, I see what you're saying now. You don't even have to assume equilibrium. You
yeah.
assume some independent deviation from, you know, equilibrium, you know, call it a power law or whatever. And then see if there's like essentially like a self-similar
exactly.
solution.
Exactly. Maybe there's a self-similar solution.
Yeah. No, that's a good idea.
So if there are no more questions, we're gonna take Dan to dinner at 5:30 this evening. And just probably in a bistro.
Okay, thank you.